Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. Pain management, medical choices, technology, and health equity all converge during this episode in a freewheeling conversation with my compatriots from the Patient Family Advisor Network, Chronic Pain Task Force. Let's unpack that stew of an introductory sentence a bit. People with chronic pain need tools and plans to manage their pain. Tools include medication, therapies, exercises, dietary, and more. We choose tools to help us manage pain best when we have a team to help us discover tools, fit the right tool to the right time and circumstances, support our experimentation, and make the whole managing process easier and easier. Technology may or may not help us connect, experiment, and make the process easier. Those of us with chronic pain do not all have access to the same variety of tools and support of team members. Inequity and institutional racism, sexism, ageism, tribalism, and other power imbalances significantly impact our ability to manage and reduce suffering from pain. In previous episodes, I introduced several projects in which I participate. Reducing opioid use and managing chronic pain from a patient's point of view. Developing an app for clinical decision support in chronic pain management. And considering equity and inclusion in patient engagement. Pain, choices, tech, and equity. Phew. Does that make any sense? Here's a map of the conversation that follows. Libby Hoy, Joan Maxwell, Charlene Setlow, and Dick Michael from the PFA Network Opioid Chronic Pain Task Force join me for a second talk about a pain management app. The first time we looked at wireframes to advise on language, content, and usefulness, wireframes are snapshots of screens of an app. I invited this group to join me again to talk about using apps in general for health and pain management. In the invite and scheduling process, they asked to broaden the conversation to health equity and patient advising. I was delighted to accept this request. I will likely interrupt the conversation from time to time to help you follow the conversation. Okay, here we go.
A while back, we had a conversation and we looked at an app. And a chronic pain management app, and a group of us gave some feedback, which was very valuable. I've been thinking about what we've done and about technology and managing health and wellness. I wanted to ask you, just in everyday life, when you have your phone and you put apps on it, that you use regularly, and why?
I use maps, of course, like Google Maps for directions. Mm-hmm. I used to use all of my airline for reservations and
travel
checking
stuff,
in. I do use Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn as my kind of social media connections. I do use Stitcher to listen to podcasts. Mm-hmm. And then I used my photos to share photos amongst our family. I do use the New York Times.
Okay.
I use, on very rare occasions, but I do sometimes use Yelp.
Okay.
To look for recommendations for things.
One of the things that's interesting to me is none of these are healthcare related.
Correct.
Say something about that. Have you ever used health and wellness types apps? And why and why not did you stop?
Unfortunately, some of my doctors use Jump Your Health and some use Diablo Valley Oncology, and they don't talk to each other very easily. And that's the main reason why I tend not to use it, is it's just frustrating. And also the Diablo Valley Oncology, it doesn't report my results. Like, I would like to know my blood test every time I go. I can't see that on there. All I can see is my height and weight, which I don't need. I already know that.
So it doesn't really
give me the info I want.
Don't they have to report blood work?
I if I ask for it, they will send it to me, but it doesn't automatically appear. I have to literally call and request it.
Interesting.
So it's just a pain. That really is annoying. And then the other thing, the John Muir Health, I do use it a little bit more, and it does put the results out there for me. But some results, like, they don't mean anything unless you have the doctor perspective. So, yes, you show this is high, but what does that mean? And what should I do about it? Mm-hmm. And the notes from your appointment will then show up, and you have those to refer to, which I guess is helpful. But I do still find that my personal connection via phone or a chat by video chat or an in-person visit is more helpful to me.
Uh-huh. Libby, what would you say different?
So I'm going to take a different tact. I use a lot of the same social media and family, but overall, I use apps that make things easier for me. So in terms of my health, the apps that I look at every day, I look at Strava every day. It records all my activities. I'm networked with my family and other friends who hold me accountable for my exercise routine. Through that, I use Peloton, the app, to get access to yoga and cycling programs online.
Uh-huh.
I use UCLA Mindfulness for meditation.
Mm-hmm.
I look at my City of Hope portal. Maybe once a week or so.
Mm-hmm.
It does get frustrating for several different reasons. Inability to correct things, most of all. But
thank you.
Number one, I don't use any social media except LinkedIn.
Okay.
I do check in on that because I still am in contact with many of my previous colleagues. And to some minor extent, my family, my brother and I do a lot of communication for scholarship work via LinkedIn. In terms of my health, I know what I have begun, staying away from any COVID-19 news because it is so skewed. I find it difficult to believe, no matter which political side or quadrant you happen to be in, I just find it very confusing.
Okay.
But I do go to NASA a lot. I go through any science application, anything that has to do with science, whether it's medical or subatomical, any of that, because I think it's just fascinating.
Okay.
But other than that, I tend to not, I'm not very social.
Okay.
I'm more of a geek.
So Dick, how about you?
I tend to use mostly, if I use health related, I guess not necessarily apps, I wouldn't even call them, but the websites are any more for the maybe most health systems, maybe Unity Point, whatever the big health systems are, Mayo Clinic dot .org or something mm-hmm. rather than anything that ends with a .com or yeah. .net, typically, for at least for COVID information. Uh-huh. I've helped develop some of those portals.
Okay.
Patient portals.
Yeah.
And I've got probably just with different provider groups, seem like all of them anymore have got their own portals. So I think probably the drug information within those provider portals are fairly well documented things. I don't think they would set themselves up for anything without having those pretty well. Mm-hmm. They've had input from medical providers on down to patient.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the information that's embedded within those portals is,
okay.
I think, fairly reputable, I think, probably. As far as other apps, I don't know. Seem like I've got 5 different ones to Zoom in, to Wovu in, to Microsoft Team Meeting in.
Okay, yes.
But probably not a lot of other apps, okay. I would say.
Although we met to discuss a patient-facing pain management app, these 4 people, not a scientific sample, don't use pain management apps, or many health apps for that matter. They do use their health system and provider practice portals with varying degrees of satisfaction. I find it challenging to locate useful information about the use of health apps. Research says that most people, 80%, have smartphones. 52% of smartphone users collect health-associated information on their devices, and 8% of smartphone users between the ages of 30 to 49 have medical app downloads. In 5 minutes of searching, I couldn't find a definition of use, just of downloads. I'm a heavy downloader of health apps, about 50 to 60 in the past 2 years, but I only use one more than once a month, Abridge. Download does not mean use. Do any of you readers or listeners know of a scientific definition for app use? Okay, let's move on to our discussion of health equity. Remember, this group asked to include health equity issues in this second evaluation call.
Talk a lot about health equity issues. And often when I'm talking about the global we, as opposed to the 5 of us. And when I hear people talking about health equity, it's mostly, so mostly meaning more than half the time, I got nothing scientific here, but people are talking about having diverse seats at the table, and or that the population of a study mirrors the population of whatever universe the study is about. And I confess to it raises my hackles in a way, because I think about patient engagement. How many times have the 5 of us or the larger group talked about the challenge of being the token patient at the table, and how hard it is to think that people are thinking we're speaking for everybody when we're smart and we're connected, but we're really not speaking for everybody. And so when somebody says we want to have more health equity, and it's okay, then we have a Hispanic at the table, or we have a person of color at the table, or we have, again, a token somebody. And that does not smell like health equity to me. But beyond that, I don't really know what it is. Meaning, when I think about technology in health, and I think about health equity is important, that people have access, that all different communities have access. I think it's important that the people's varied circumstances are considered in the design of tools that are supposed to help make things easier. But that's about as far as I've thought about it. And I want to think about it more deeply. And we know about pain. And we know about, that's how we met. Or I met you guys in this opioid pain thing. And I think I should be thinking more about health equity and the work that we're doing. But I don't even know the questions to ask. I feel like there's something here. And I just, I'm looking for some thoughts from you guys. Like, how do you think about this stuff? Joan, I want to start with you.
I just want to tell you a really quick story. So I'm on the Patient Family Advisory Committee at John Muir Hospital. Their second hospital in Concord has a little more diverse population. I'm sitting on the Nurses Council there this year, and they are taking on a special project, and the project has to do with patient belongings. And so I'm the patient representative for this discussion about patient belongings. People bring in guns, knives, drugs, their belongings because they're homeless. Mm-hmm. And the hospital is trying to figure out how to keep their staff safe. Their patients have some level of respect and for their belongings, etc. And here I am, the patient, on this conversation who's not homeless and doesn't have guns or knives or drugs or anything. So I think that's a good example for
it
me
is.
of what health equity would be. Now, how are you going to have a homeless person in the room maybe asking them the question? I don't exactly know. And certainly I did my best to reach out and ask patients, what are the belongings that are worried about when you go to the hospital, and did my best to do some research and have good feedback. But I'm just saying, I'm a poor person for that project.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, just a simple example of health equity needs.
Oh, that's a priceless example, actually. Thank you. Wow, that is really interesting. Charlene, what about you?
Danny, I was just going to echo your very same words. That is an excellent example. I'm fortunate in the fact that I have never been in those situations. So that would probably have never occurred to me that although we do have a few homeless here in my neighborhood, I just walked by one this morning. She had managed to get out of her wheelchair onto the lawn because it was cool. And I did stop and ask her if she's going to be able to get back into her chair. And she assured me that she would be able to do that. But it is interesting how when you've never been exposed nor never wandered into those areas, the lack of awareness, and I must admit I was shocked at myself to have never thought about the drugs particularly, and opioid being another one. We all know people who have taken that. So in terms of inclusion, mm-hmm. for economic reasons, for all of the other reasons that we try to be inclusive, that is a very difficult question because my local community is mostly Latino. We do have a few African Americans. We do have a few Native Americans. We do have some Hispanic, some Asian, some Japanese. We do have a few, but we're not really terribly diversified here in terms of those other areas. And religiously also, it's vast majority are Christian, whether it's Catholic or Mormon or LDS or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think you just have to keep working at it and increasing our own awareness, just as Joan has done. And Libby, you probably are another good example of that, having come into contact. Is serving on several of the other family councils, Danny, I am with you. They're not terribly inclusive. And the cohorts in some of the studies that have been, that I've looked at the abstracts from Macquarie, number one, there is a paucity of women who are represented because most of those cohorts come from the VA hospitals. Now, that's changing gradually over time, so there are more and more women included. Mm-hmm. But in the past, it was all men, which is why women's health studies, heart studies, have been so far behind the times because we were never included. So I don't know. It's just very difficult. You just have to keep working at it.
One of the places, and I use this example because it's the only one I have, is that I reviewed a funding request once where respite care was budgeted for caregivers' carees so that caregivers could participate in leadership in a research study. And I thought, now that's inclusion. That they put their money where their mouth was. It's one thing to have to say you want seats, people to have seats at the table. It's another to understand the challenges that it takes to be there. Dick, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking of you were talking about your conversation there about the hospital that I worked at and the broader system now that I'm involved in governance for. They have whatever they call them, diversity councils or something mm-hmm. like that. And that typically is made of all providers probably within they're all nurses typically, or they're quality improvement people or mm-hmm. or things, and they're predominantly Christian, they're predominantly white here in Iowa, but the bigger system is a diverse population group. And I always think, and you don't have any patients on your diversity council. That's the first step. Get a patient on there. They probably don't want me, but if they do, they're going to hear that just like we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Gosh, I don't know what it's like to be fortunately poor and on a medical drug seeking somebody who lives in a homeless shelter at night. That's a large number of population, but I can't represent that very well. But mm-hmm. I don't wonder if that's typical that those cultural diversity councils, whatever kind of a title they put on them, who makes those up? Anybody know about that?
You're asking a question. All I would say right now is it really varies.
Patient caregiver engagement can occur in governance, that's strategy and the board, design or planning, operations, running the place, and learning, research and quality improvement. A diversity council could span all of these. Diversity seems necessary but not sufficient. Inclusion of patients, caregivers, acute users, those are one-time or preventative users, or chronic frequent users, teens, single parents, elderly, those with handicaps. Then what's their authority? Listen only, advise, plan, decide, disseminate.
Libby, what's your experience?
We, as an organization, have been on a journey since Memorial Day weekend to dive further into equity and what does it, and struggling with a lot of these same questions, Danny, for sure. And it's not that I have an answer per se, but I'll share what I've learned thus far.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that is, and this is in large part due to the diversity, equity, and inclusion work group that we started. So a work group like this one. Mm-hmm. However, that is made up of 10 members of the PFA network who represent the Black community. So they're leading out. And what I have learned from them is to shift my thinking a bit from we need to create seats at the table to we need to provide the hammer, the nails, and the wood and encourage other communities who are underrepresented to build the tables and invite us to them. And that's a real flip in the thinking. As I have spoken with this work group more and more, I think that we get to equity not by just inclusion. One of our core values as an organization has always been inclusion. And to everyone who has entered our door, we've been inclusive. But equity means you have more than one door, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, at this point, we are really adopting the value of create multiple doors and create doors in communities that have been underserved, rather than asking homeless to come to us. How can we go out, Joan, and have some conversations and do peanut butter and generous? So our staff retreats, alas, before COVID, we would come in and make sack lunches, peanut butter, jelly sandwiches, and a piece of fruit, and go and take it to the homeless in our community and just have a conversation about, that foot looks horrible. How are you getting that cared for? And what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
And then I think that's a very first step. What I'm learning a lot about is the need to build trust with underserved populations so that it's not a trend in response to George Floyd, or it's not that token. I hear a lot of pushback from my colleagues who are people of color who are saying, don't just start something as a token. I've kind of come to think about, and I don't know if I'm correct, but come to think about, if we're challenging ourselves to do something completely different, it's going to be token for a while. The proof will be sustaining it, right? And growing it and nurturing it and developing it. I think when I started this journey, I thought of diversity, inclusion, and equity all the same. It's all the same thing. It all wraps up together. But I'm now seeing each as it complements and supports the other.
My friend and colleague Jan Oldenburg turned me on to an article in Health Affairs entitled On Racism, a New Standard for Publishing on Racial Health Inequities. Trust and inequities and institutional racism bind together to impact chronic pain management and all ill health for that matter. We often think of inequities in terms of genetics, race, and ethnicity, but that puts it on the individual and avoids questioning institutional racism, sexism, ageism, whatever power imbalances.
That's interesting. I have a dear friend who has sickle cell, and she and I became close a number of years ago and over chronic illness challenges. And then she moved away and got pregnant and was living in a strange community and trying to deal with pain management in a hostile environment. And first of all, it still wasn't about technology. That's for damn sure. I could be helpful and supportive to her, but it was more, I learned way more than I offered in terms of the experience. So I'm appreciating what you're saying about the hammer, the nails, and the wood. And being present for a few moments in somebody else's life and trying to learn the circumstances, the challenges, and then ask the questions or listen for the questions they're asking. And then thinking about what are the tools. So here I'm thinking about, this is a pain management app is how this conversation started. And we're not going to learn that with a bunch of clinical decision support techno geeks sitting around the table. You know, that's just
not, that doesn't have value. And I am also thinking about power, and I would love to hear you guys' thoughts in terms of, it's not a finite entity that I have and I give to somebody else. I don't think it is. I think when we have equity, everybody has power over their own health, over their own trajectory. I don't know that one replaces another. And I think that's an important piece to hold on to. I'm not saying I'm holding my space. I have given up my seat. I've given up our budget. I've given up all because I believe strongly that's the move right now. That's important. But I think over the long haul, I just don't think of power as a finite thing that I can impart on somebody else. That's pretty high an idea of me, isn't it? So
yes, interesting.
That doesn't feel good.
Libby, I concur. You really cannot empower another person. That power has to come within that person. Unfortunately, some people have more of a reserve and are able to draw upon that power. But I concur. It's a two-way street. Our electromagnetic waves go in both directions.
But I do think that you can change the circumstances around people to help raise empowerment and resilience. I do.
Yes.
Certainly.
But you can't really give it to them. You can make it available.
Joan, I see a question or a comment on your face. Is that right?
Don't play poker.
I think this is such an interesting conversation. And so just first of all, Danny, thanks for allowing us to have it. I heard a story that a woman's with hospitals closing in rural areas that I heard a story, a woman interviewed on, I think it was 60 Minutes, and her husband had died because they couldn't, the hospital was now over 200 miles away and they couldn't get there. And there had been a hospital nearby. To me, that was health equity. And then the other thing I heard about rural is the need for therapy for people, for teenagers who are struggling and maybe have addiction issues and need serious therapy and help, and doing that by telehealth. Is there a way that we can help them? So I feel like there's so many like examples that I've heard, but like to your point, Danny, which I think is so interesting, is how do we pull it all together? Like, how do we talk about it? How do we help as patients? So I really like what Libby said. I think that's probably the look on my face that you were reading, was appreciating her saying that it's giving them the tools and letting them lead the way. I think up until she said that, I was still thinking we had to help them.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge to record your doctor visit. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com, abridge.com, or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went.
When something is really hard for me to get my head around, I tend to revert to, what are the questions I need to ask? Because I'm a nurse, and I'm a nurse's problem solver. And mama, do it, figure it out. Okay, you got this problem. What are we going to do about it? Blah, blah, blah. But that's okay. Not always the most, it has its place, but it's not always the most helpful. And this is one of those situations that I feel like I need to figure out when I'm in a venue that may not be as friendly as this one, where I feel like I can just try stuff out for size and we'll just have an exchange. But I feel like what I need is like some questions to ask, and questions like, how can something that would maybe shift the conversation or direct the conversation. So I think about that with these people who are developing this pain app and or whatever it is. Like, what are the questions? I feel I can't just say, it's not sufficient to say, what about health equity? Like, that is just not a helpful question. This is my last question. So what are questions that we can ask when we're in a setting where we're an advisor? And to stimulate a helpful conversation, a shift in thinking Libby has been talking about.
I guess one thing that comes to mind specifically related to the health app is who is going to be using it and what do they need to be able to use it effectively.
Okay.
I think too, and Danny, I totally am action oriented too. And so I want to just jump in and solve. And it's been a remarkable lesson in self-restraint to slow down and realize my husband dropped me off for work today. And he said, so what are you working on today? I said, well, you've got opioids, equity, and then COVID. And he goes, yeah, good luck. I'm thinking, you're like, why do I think that I have any solutions to any of this? You have to commit to the process on this one, and it's not clean and it's not easy. I love Joan's questions. I would ask, who could benefit most from this technology? Like, who is marginalized right now that could benefit most from this technology that we're moving through? And then that might lead to Joan's question of what do they need? What do they need to be able to access it?
So meaning like in one of the examples, not closing down hospitals as a business decision and thinking about access, or is there broadband so that these things right. can be used? Is that kind of thing?
Yeah. Should we be partnering with the Institute for Technology Access, or okay, Janice has been talking about it. But yeah, should we be partnering with this group, or should we be partnering with community-based organizations that support underserved populations to make sure we know? It's so clear to me now that it's the same thing as designing a hospital flow policy without asking the patient. Like, you're going to miss, you're going to design something that works for the organization. But the risk of missing what your patients need is really high. This is the same thing. How did we assume we would know what was needed for some of these communities without asking that? Or yeah. You hear meeting people where they are. We strive at that. But to do that, you have to go into your community, establish some trusting relationships, and work together. I don't
ask, as Joan said,
ask what do you those need? Questions. Yes.
Yeah. Dick, what do you think?
I'm just thinking how different this conversation we're having today would be a year ago from today, or a year from now from today, just the things that this COVID has adjusted. Go to a community meeting and talk about who has community meetings anymore. We're still not meeting as groups. Hospitals and provider groups, they're more interested in their bottom line right now and trying to keep open. Where are the patients coming from? What kind of patients am I going to get and take care of them? This pandemic has thrown a lot of a lot of things into motion that isn't easily solved besides taking care of patients and making patients well, and public health concerns and stuff that I don't know how it's going to be hard to get equity on the front burner, I'm afraid, Danny.
Yeah, okay.
I hate that. I hate it, but...
No, that's okay. No, hey. It sounds real.
It is. It absolutely is. And I just keep thinking, but it's a public health crisis. Shouldn't be that be the time that we're talking to the public?
Yes.
And you're right, Dick. You're absolutely right. It's very hard to prioritize equity. And at the same time, I feel like it's a solution in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
All right. Two things. Any last words of wisdom?
That's a pregnant pause.
I got nothing.
Yeah. With all of this conversation, and of course with my bias, I really feel that there is going to be a lot more technology involved, and I don't quite understand Here locally, we do have a lot of telemed because, of course, we're close to Stanford and the community hospital in Monterey, which serves Carmel, which the myth is such a wealthy community. It's really not. There's a lot of money there, but they come and go. I think a lot more technology is going to be involved. And I think one way to reach some of the homeless and the people who are displaced and not duly represented in finding out what they really need is to simply take a laptop and go out and ask them. And unfortunately, there's going to be a certain number of the population who won't really trust that technology. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have to build some trust, as Libby has mentioned. But at least that would be a start. And you could find out if, in fact, for those people who are in desperate need, who need emergency help, there it is. You can take mm-hmm. it back and find out if somebody can go and help them somehow, some way, and build a partnership with emergency area offices. We do have urgent care here, but of course it's not mobile. You have to go into them. And mm-hmm. it would be nice if there were people like you, Danny, who nursing with are able to take their skills out into the field. My sister-in-law had done that. And of course, Visiting Nurses is another organization that does go out into the homes and care for some patients. And I don't know if they would go to a homeless shelter or not. I'm sure they probably do. But when you stop to think about it, there's lots of opportunity. It's just getting it down to some place where it's manageable and also something that can be an ongoing, not a flash in the pan, so to speak. Something that's sustainable.
Thank you.
Charlene, that was so well said. I just want to add to that as I think about it. It reminds me of one of the many things I've learned from Black Lives Matter is that really the place that I can help is in my own community. Don't go and march in Oakland, but stay in my town and figure out what needs to be done there and help do that. And I wonder if health equity is somewhat similar in that you can't lump homelessness and poverty and rural and all the different issues, prejudice, everything that we're talking about together, but rather you have to go to each community and figure out what they need and really address those individual needs in that community, which I think, Charlene, you probably said a lot better than I just did, but it just made me think that community-based approach is so mm-hmm. critical.
Thank you. Awesome. All right, guys. Thank you so much. This was very valuable for me.
Okay, we did it. Pain management, medical choices, technology, and health equity in one conversation. Sifting sand through the screen, I hear confirmation that people do not commonly use pain apps for pain management. Perhaps we haven't found the function most needed yet. I hear that these patient family advisors deeply consider the challenge of health equity. They're aware of their privilege and limited perspective. They're attracted to impact health equity in the communities they know and share the skills learned with communities they don't know. Chronic pain is universal. Health equity is complicated. My lesson today, open mind, open heart, experiment. Thanks for joining us. Keep the faith. Onward. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.